Hey everybody, J.J. Cooper, Carlos Clausa, Baseball America Draft Podcast. We got to hang out together at the Under Armour Next All-American Game last weekend. Now we're going to talk draft updates, ranking updates that are coming, the end of the summer showcase season, and also what we saw this past weekend with some of the top high school players from around the country. Carlos, great to see you. How are you doing? We're going to be into ranking update season before we know it, I feel like.
Yeah, I mean, it is in some ways, it's kind of like a year-round thing for us now with our iterative rankings. We're always trying to keep things updated, but we have reached what I would say is kind of a dead period in terms of I feel like now officially done with the summer showcase circuit.
I would say one more event that kind of fits in it, right? Because technically the PBR event is still before we get to fall.
Whether or not you want to call that fall or summer, I guess I would let you go either way. But the bulk of this showcase season is kind of wrapped up for us. We've seen a lot of players. We've been exposed to a lot of players that maybe we haven't seen in the past. And essentially over the next month or so for me, I'm going to be doing as much reporting and work as I can to make sure our next update for the 2027 class really reflects what we've seen from players and what we've seen from the class this summer, both on the college and high school side. So it's an exciting time. It feels like this is really the first time where you can go back over your notes and really take a longer process and a deeper kind of look at each player and work through them. And this is really where the class starts to come together in a more detailed way for me personally. Obviously, people like Ben who've been covering this class, this is kind of just the next stage for them. But I'd say for me, for you, and for the bulk of the industry, most teams don't have a lot of full-time underclass scouts rolling around, although all the area guys do a really good job just getting updated with most of their top underclassmen. So they're aware of these guys, but for them as well, they've got a chance now to really come into this class rested, further away from the 2026 draft, and start to sink their teeth into the class. So it's a fun time of year.
As you said, they're aware of it, but at the same time, there's no need to bear down on it the same way, right? If you know that you have a sophomore in your area who's going to be a stud, you start paying attention. You might see him, but you're not going to be like, oh, I've really got to break down that swing and how it's going to project yet. Now we're at that point.
There's a different pace and a different sort of level of depth in the reporting at this stage. Like you said, we have basically a full year until the draft itself. A lot of these players are going to continue evolving and changing, but it's kind of starting the process of getting all of your evaluations, starting the early processes for teams and getting their priority guys bucketed, whether or not it's a specific board that's a long way away from the team side. But for us, we do have a board that is kind of up regularly throughout the year. So we'll be a little bit more particular about how each individual player is lining up in connection with players outside of the area. I just love that process. And for me, JJ, this stage of the year, I don't know if you feel differently about it covering the draft. We cover it in different ways. But it's always very refreshing to me at this stage because we're just now seeing the 2026 players get their taste in pro ball. And it's like, okay, we just spent a full year on those guys, and every year I feel like the discovery process, the initial conversations of, oh, do you like this pitcher versus this pitcher? How do you compare this shortstop to this other shortstop? I just love those conversations. I love the process of building the board, and I'm just excited for this next update. So I
kind of, with that, the logical question we ask is, so how much, like, we came in, we already have a full ranking, but I do feel like that we should prepare people for the fact of when, say, how much will this change? A lot will change in this ranking because we have, as you said, there's been a lot done over the summer, especially on the high school side. Some on the college side too, but on the high school side, you really, the summer before your draft year doesn't write anything in Sharpie, right? You can still think of this as more like an eraser mate, those old pens that you could erase, right? You can still change your what happens, but it's also not pencil either. Like a lot of what you do this summer will stick with you whatever you do next high school season as well. So on the good or the bad, right?
Yeah, I would say for different demographics, the summer probably carries a little bit more weight or less weight depending on what position you play, if you're in college or if you're in high school. I think the most maybe the most meaningful demographic in terms of how much the summer matters for where teams are viewing you next year is high school hitters. Because teams just really value the performance and some of the underlying process numbers that they can tease out from the summer when you're playing against the best competition in the country, especially if you come from a state or a high school that isn't known for playing the best competition. It is a lot harder to read into performance numbers during the spring. On the summer, everyone is on a pretty level playing field and facing the best competition that you really can face. And so we saw last year, Jared Greinlinger, I think, is a great example. He wasn't even in the current year class at the time, but what jumped Jared Greinlinger's stock heading into the spring after he did reclassify and why a lot of teams started to really prioritize him as a hitter was because his summer contact skills were exceptional, some of the best we've seen. I mean, he was one of the top high school players selected in last year's draft, and I think a large part of that is because his summer data, his summer performance was so strong and so good. At the opposite end of the spectrum, you have guys like Brady Harris, who entered the summer as a potential top 10 pick. We had him inside the top 10 of our way too early mock draft. That's one that would have liked to have back. Because he struggled throughout the summer. He showed a lot more swing and miss than expected. He was not the sort of pure hitter that we had seen as an underclassman. He really regressed in that area. And if he had a strong spring, there's a chance he could have put himself in a position to be drafted. But I don't know that, regardless of the caliber of the spring season that he had, if he ever would have put himself back inside that top 10 conversation, just because the summer kind of buried him a little bit. And so both positively and negatively for high school hitters, I think the summer is massively important. We have a decent idea of like the players who just stood out at events that we've seen, at events that we've just reported on, heard from, seen the performance remotely, excuse me. And so I'd say that demographic probably should have the most movement that is representative and has a lot of signal behind it. That's not to say that pitchers like George Ferguson aren't going to move up as well, because certainly every player can move the needle and move their draft stock in some different areas. But I think that just the high school hitters, the weight is probably most meaningful for them.
That's the thing I was going to say also with this when it comes to the high school class. The hitters, I do feel like you just kind of laid out, it's more important for the hitters than it is for the pitchers, because what we see from the pitchers during the summer, you're seeing it, but you really are seeing a little bit of, unless you are looking, trying to scout the next reliever, which no one's trying to scout high school pitchers like, oh, I think that guy's going to be a good reliever in 7 years. That's not really what you're looking for. You're not generally seeing these pitchers in their full natural environment, right? You're seeing a little bit artificial. It's the showcase season, right? Like you're seeing them. I was at a game Sunday, and the goal was there are basically 9 guys on each of these pitching staffs who are going to pitch. Well, mm-hmm. You're going to go an inning. Maybe you're going to go a little more than an inning. That's it.
Right.
That's not the same thing as what you're going to see in a high school season.
Absolutely. You hear scouts talk about seeing pitchers when they get extended. And essentially what that means is they're throwing longer outings. In the summer, we will see maybe 3 inning stints from players who are being viewed as starters on national teams at events like East Coast Pro area code games. The starters in those games, they tend to go 3 innings, but for the most part, that's the max that you're seeing throughout the summer. You may be turning over a lineup once, and because we're dealing with extended lineups where there could be 9, 10, 11, 12, 13 players in a lineup, you don't even need to get through a full lineup and still have the advantage of a hitter not having seen you. And so the shorter outings allows you to throw harder. Your average velocity is going to be quite a bit higher than it'll be next spring when you're stretched out and you know you have to work through 6 or 7 innings for a high school starter at this level. You expect them to kind of take the ball and throw the bulk of the game. And so next spring, you'll get a much better understanding of how a pitcher navigates that multiple times through the order, how they maintain their stuff over a longer outing. And to your point, in the summer, they are being scouted and evaluated and showcased in a much more limited innings scenario. And so they're throwing for the radar gun in a lot of situations. You're seeing much more of the top end velocity more frequently than if you're going to look at a pitcher who throws one inning and say, oh, he was 96, 97. next spring when he stretched out, you're probably going to have that average velocity come down, even though there are going to be some guys who take some steps forward velocity-wise, physicality-wise. I also think it is easier to, if you missed a pitcher throughout the entirety of the summer, you didn't see him at all, it is easier to have an accurate evaluation of a pitcher during the spring than it would be for a hitter. You can get a good idea of what he does now, how he projects moving forward, and not worry quite as much about a lack of history. Whereas with a hitter, you just need so many ABs and so many high quality ABs that you probably would feel a little bit more nervous going into a big money sort of decision on that player heading into the draft. So those are all the reasons why I think it's more meaningful for the high school hitters.
I will say, for all of the, you hear a lot like, oh, you know, the showcase and the tournament schedule and all, and how bad it is for amateur baseball. But there is something that is absolutely also true, which is I 100% believe that when it comes to scouting high school players for the draft, there is a lot of improvement in the evaluations that have come from the fact that, you know, this, again, when we're now a generation plus removed from when this did not exist. But I remember the story, that I've probably said on the podcast before, but I remember writing a story about Byron Buxton when he was coming up through the minors and talking to a lot of Twins officials about him and asking, you know, kind of there on the amateur side, their scouting department, and asking different scouts, like, what's the best that you all saw Byron Buxton face? What's the best pitcher he faced at Appling County, his high school senior season? It's like, there was probably one guy who could probably pitch at a JUCO who was mid-80s, I think. That was it. Like, so if you were trying to evaluate Byron Buxton purely off of his high school schedule, you would be like, how do we feel confident taking this guy high? But you see him in the summer against premium velocity. We're talking about, again, what you just laid out. You're seeing these pitchers, in a lot of ways, high school pitchers, at their very best. That's also the challenge that these hitters face, which is, you're getting them at their best velocity. You're getting their best stuff because they know they don't have to save anything. They're not worried about how what they're going to do against you the next time. They're giving you everything they have right now. Now, before we move on to kind of some of the players that stand out this, I do want to ask on the college side, we have info. We have some players who clearly have adjusted what the viewpoint of them, what the evaluation is by what they've done in summer ball. In some cases, what they did, you know, Team USA, you know, we had college national team.
Yeah.
But when it comes to, and you've kind of laid out how this kind of creates a little bit of something that we want to make sure that we're adjusting for. A lot of these players, though, a lot of the top college players in our rankings kind of go into almost a little bit of public hibernation during this time, don't they?
Right. Yeah, they do. I mean, there are a lot of players that we just didn't see very much at all throughout the summer. There are a lot of pitchers who didn't throw at all. I think just the state of college summer leagues is so unusual these days and so split in terms of the rosters pre and post draft. So players bouncing between different leagues, bouncing from USA trials then to the Cape. Like, you might not see hitters extended at all. You're gonna, the same is true of pitchers in the summer, with outside of a few exceptions, there are not a lot of pitchers who are really stretching out and throwing a ton. And so I think it's, and for the college players, both pitching and hitting, the spring is so impactful for their draft stock, and you have such a longer playing time window to evaluate them. The competition level is significantly better than the high schoolers. I do think that for the most part, the spring season is going to carry a lot more weight. In the past, and I think even still, teams are going to value WOODBAT track record that you have with college players, but just because of how the summer has evolved and changed for players focusing on their development in labs, focusing on getting stronger, and the fact that the pitching has really just been down in these summer leagues, I do think that maybe the WOODBAT track record is not quite as valued as it has been in the past. You almost can't, because you're just not getting the same volume of at-bats and playing time and quality of competition. So for me, what's interesting is, like, kind of putting eyes on the top players who are at Team USA, who stands out in the Cape, who are the big transfers, because that's such a prominent aspect of the college side of the game. Who are the big transfers who are moving to power conferences that we're maybe getting a little bit of a teaser for, that we should circle On our list as we head into the spring, I'm looking at a guy like Jamie Leskovsky, who is a shortstop. He's going to be playing for North Carolina. They've done a really nice job in the past with getting these sort of mid-major players and pulling them into UNC. Guys like Jake Schaffner, Owen Hull from last year's draft. So I think players like that who are going out and performing, and you're getting a little bit of a taste of what they do well. I'm also thinking of a guy like Jack Ohman, who was exceptional as a freshman with Yale and maybe didn't pitch quite as good as he did as a freshman during his sophomore year.
I don't think there's a maybe about that.
Yeah, he definitely didn't. He didn't pitch quite as well. And then you see him in the summer, and he looked like the Jack Ohman of old, who we were thinking about as a potential top 15 player. So with the college players, I don't want to read too much into everything. And you also have an upcoming fall evaluation period that I do think is really meaningful. We can see some of those in person, but a lot of that is just like hearing from scouts who are the players who are really taking off, adding velocity, looking good in the fall. So yeah, that's kind of broadly how I would describe like how I'm looking at the college class and maybe some of the differences with the high schoolers.
So we're going to dive in now to some of the names of players who really have kind of risen up, what we're hearing, what we're seeing this summer. We'll do that right after this quick break. So Carlos, let's kind of get into some of the nitty gritty of this. Like, we'll give a little sneak peek of kind of, you know, get a lot more reporting to do, but when you look at our rankings, when I look at them, it's like, I can't wait till we update these, because some of the guys we know are going to move, some down, right, but a lot of them up.
Yeah.
Who are some of the guys who stand out to you as far as, okay, after the summer, this player is definitely going to be climbing when we do our next rankings update?
Yeah, three of the high school players, I think we can bucket it maybe into a high school conversation and then a college conversation, but three of the high school players, I feel like you got to see them all at the this past weekend at the Under Armour Next All America game. So maybe that's a nice, maybe we'll talk about the college players first and then transition into the high school players.
Yeah, I think that's actually a good way to do it. So let's talk about the college guys first. You mentioned but let's talk about, like a Jamie Leskovsky, who was in the Cape, is headed to North Carolina. What is it about him coming off of William & Mary, a couple years at William & Mary, what is it about him that kind of will probably push him up the next time we do an update?
I feel like anytime you are leading the list of our Cape Cod top prospects or at the very top of the list, Jamie was number two on that list. It's a player that kind of should be aware of. And I also feel like Jamie Leskovsky has the sort of profile that we just saw teams massively reward in the draft in 2026. So purely from a demographic and like innate skill set standpoint, I feel like Leskovsky is a player who we should be very aware of and very eager to move him up the board if the performance and the feedback warrants it. And what we've seen from him at William & Mary for 2 years is a player who makes a ton of contact, gets on base a lot, and also had a pretty dramatic step forward in in-game power, going from two homers in 2025 to 13 in 2026. Layering on that strength with an up-the-middle shortstop profile, it sounds like there might be some questions about whether or not he's a better fit long-term for shortstop or second base. Those are questions that can be answered next spring. But anytime you are a shortstop at a power conference, in particular the SEC or the ACC, you make a lot of contact. That's a profile that like you should be very, very careful about missing or being light on, I think, especially after what we saw from 2026. I mean, a lot of Laskowski's profile right now already reads like Jake Schaffner, and Jake Schaffner was the kind of big surprise first rounder. His pro debut is going pretty well right now. So that's a player that I'm super excited about just in general, and I would expect him to be an up arrow mover. And I will say at this stage, as we're talking about all these players, we don't have like set positions for where they're going to move up now, but we do have a fairly good idea of the players who have just performed and are ranked low enough to warrant pretty significant or notable up arrow jumps. Laskowski would be near the top of that list, I would say.
A couple things that stand out to me about him. One is that unlike a lot of guys that we talk about with summer, 27 games in the Cape, so like 115 plate appearances. So we're talking about, by summer standards, a pretty large sample to go on what you're using Synergy Sports data, 11% swing and miss this summer, which that's
tremendous.
That's really good. And by the way, for a guy who hit for average, got on base as well. I will say you mentioned like it's a hit first profile right now. He did show increased power last year. In the summer with a wood bat, did hit a couple of homers, but it's a very up the middle profile. And it was a really, if you said there were 30 hits, four doubles, two homers, a lot of singles up the middle, a lot of line drives, but line drives in front of the outfielders, not behind them. Right. You would say that, like, if you said, like, okay, what are you looking for? What are you going to be evaluating? His power with wood seems to be still something that's on the come more than it is something that he presently has. But as you just laid out, that's the part of the profile that we're seeing that teams right now are like, give us the hitters. We think we can develop the power rather than give us the power and we hope we can develop the hit.
Absolutely. Yeah, so, the next player I would mention here, we talked about Jack Oman. Maybe we can just finish the conversation off on him. I believe he was the top-ranked pitcher on our Cape Cod list. Jeff Ponce always does a really nice job with this list. He ranked number 4 on the board. And like I mentioned with Jack, his first year with Yale, it was exceptional. Put him on the map. He had a 1.10 ERA over 73.2 innings. That backed up to a 5.53 ERA in 2026 over 66.2 innings. The one thing that I like about Jack in both years are the peripherals are really strong. I don't think his walk rate did jump about 3 percentage points from 6.9, essentially 7% to 10%. The strikeout rate was pretty similar year over year. And I do think that his jump in ERA is probably a little bit overstated in terms of his actual peripherals, the stuff, his ability to throw strikes in a deep mix that we saw. It sounds like he was exceptional throughout the summer. The stuff was good. The fastball was in the mid-90s. I don't know that a single hitter hit his fastball hard. He throws a slider. He throws a curveball. He's got a changeup. He has starter traits and a starter look on the mound. So whether or not it's just, hey, this sophomore year was a little bit, the numbers maybe were a little bit inflated based on like the pure stuff, or it's just him making some adjustments and getting back to the pitcher he was in 2025. There's probably a little bit of both in there, but I think it's only encouraging to see what he did this summer. Also, like, I don't know how teams will view this. I'm sure some teams will be maybe bummed to not see him pitching in the ACC or SEC because he certainly had the opportunity. If he wanted to transfer out of Yale, other scouts will look at it and say, hey, we really appreciate the commitment to sticking with your program. It's almost irrelevant like what you think about that. Regardless, Jack Oman is a very talented pitcher. He's going to be in the mix with this deep college pitching class in 2027. So he's a guy I could see moving maybe a little bit closer to kind of where we had him in previous iterations of this board. Certainly a player who's going to be in the mix for a potential first-round pick, I would say, at this stage.
And I would say also, again, when you talk about this, as far as top-tier pitching prospects, probably saw more from him this summer than we saw from almost anyone else as far as, you know, and again, not that he was going out there like 10 times or anything like that at the Cape, but going out there multiple times. And I would also say, though, you just kind of hit on it, what we just talked about on the high school side, it's probably a little more important for him. Pitchers can be evaluated throwing against air, basically, in some ways. Like the pitches are the pitches. But seeing him in the Cape do it probably is a little more important for a guy who said like he's going back to the Ivy League, which, hey, guys get drafted out of the Ivy League too, but no one's going to say that the level of hitter competition you're going to face game in, game out is going to be anything like what you see in the biggest conferences. So that probably is a little more important for him. I think you had one more college guy that you wanted to cover, though, as well.
Yeah, it did. Will Sanford, a right-handed pitcher at Oregon. I think he's a name that we definitely want to highlight here and circle. And he made a significant change this past spring in his second year with Oregon. He moved into the Friday night role. And the big thing that he improved was his strike throwing. He walked 22% of the batters he faced in 2025. As a starter, that's like one of the higher rates you'll see for a starting pitcher, even at the college level. He improved it. It's still a below average walk rate in 2026, but going from a 22% walk rate to a 12.5% walk rate is a pretty dramatic increase in just being around the zone. I think what was encouraging for scouts who watched him this summer with Team USA is he was generally also around the zone, especially with his fastball. I think for him moving forward, it's going to be, hey, can you continue to maintain the strides you've already made and then also improve some of the location and strike throwing ability with your secondaries in particular? I think the fastball being a reliable in-zone pitch is great. And Will Sanford is also the sort of pitcher who has just exceptional pure stuff in an unusual movement combination to where if he is going to be around the zone more frequently, I would expect him to dominate hitters. He did that this past spring. He led Team USA with 8 strikeouts in official games when they were playing international competition. And he's maybe not the biggest pitcher in the world. He's just 6 foot, 200 pounds. Actually, both Will Sanford and Jack Oman, I believe, are listed at 6 foot exactly. But he's been up to 97. He has tremendous riding life. It's a hammer curveball that he pairs with that fastball at the bottom of the zone. And then he'll also mix in a slider. We'll see if he incorporates more of a changeup next spring. But in terms of power stuff and unique release traits, movement traits for the arsenal, Will Sanford would rank towards the top of, again, a very deep college pitching class.
I think nowadays, if you're a 6 foot pitcher, you know, who has, again, who has that kind of life with your fastball, I don't think, as long as teams feel like that you have enough strength, I don't think that they look at that nearly as a don't look at nearly as worrisome about that as they used to, because you know right. that kind of generates a little bit more of an unusual look than if you've got your typical 6 foot three, you know, normal release point kind of guy.
And we'll probably say this a lot throughout covering this class, but Will Sanford is a guy who's going to enter the spring with 120 plus innings under his resume. He's already got 27 starts, even with that strike throwing background. So I think he's already starting in a pretty good place. And when you pair that with the summer, with the pure stuff, really exciting to see if like 2026 is the new baseline for him, or was just kind of one step forward and he's going to take another. If he takes another step forward with the command and we're looking at like a sub 10% walk rate, we could be having a lot of conversations about which of these top end pitchers he stacks up with. And he ranked number 6 on our Team USA top 10. I feel like that's a pretty loud ranking for him.
So we're going to cover now some of the high school players who stood out this summer. And we'll do that right after one more break. So, Carlos, we can kind of wrap the hitters here into kind of also kind of our Under Armour thoughts. Which was at Camden Yards. We're recording this past weekend, and they were all there. I think everyone that we're going to talk about now on the high school side was there. So it's a pretty good time, pretty easy. You're going to have really good video on the YouTube channel. If you listen on the pod and you want to see some of these guys, head over to the YouTube channel, because we wanted to make sure that we have good video of these guys. I feel like we really do. So,
and we also, I'll just plug the piece that you and I co-authored. Mm-hmm. If you want more of our thoughts on these players and then additional names who stood out to us, like Jay just said, we were both there. And we've got a bunch of reports and I think video on every player that we wrote about on the site as well. So check out that piece at baseballamerica.com. But JJ, where should we start?
I was gonna say, if there's not video on there, was something that we just failed to upload it, because I know we have video of every, like we have a lot of video of every player from this, from in-game for a lot of guys, for most every guy, and also from the workout on Saturday. But okay, 3 hitters. Well, okay, there are several, there's a couple of guys here. There's 2.5 hitters here, I would say. But I do bring that up because we can start with, okay, the easiest one to say here who'll definitely be rising up the rankings in our 2027 update is Colin Scott, because the last
going time from not this, ranked to ranked,
he was the 2028. He's reclassified. Right. Ben Badler broke that story over at baseballamerica.com and explained in it, kind of Colin Scott explained that, hey, he wants to be a two-way player. That's kind of one of the reasons for this is as he goes through the recruiting process, he thinks of himself as a pitcher and a hitter, and he wants to do both, and he wants to do both in college. So he's kind of indicating, doesn't mean he won't get drafted, but it kind of indicating strong possibility of him going to school, uncommitted right now, because he was a 28, and the 28 contact period started not that long ago. But I bring that up because obviously he's been one of the stories this summer pitching-wise. He's touched 100 miles an hour. He also went 4-for-4 in the Under Armour game with a double.
Yeah, I was about to say, the running joke on future projection with me and Ben is that Ben wants every player to be a two-way player now and for eternity, and I want them all to pick a side. But I feel like for Cullen Scott, last weekend at Under Armour was an excellent showcase of his actual talent on both sides of the ball, because we were watching him in batting practice, and I'd say in a park that seems to favor lefties for just showing off power, Cullen Scott, right-handed hitter, showed maybe some of the best raw power that we saw. He's this big, physical, 6'3", 225-pound kid who just generates a lot of raw power with a ton of ease. Like you mentioned, he's touched 100 miles per hour on the mound. In this game, he was up to 98 and in the 96, 97 mile per hour range pretty consistently. I've seen him with just like tremendous ease at that range in the past as well. And then adding to the power on the mound, the power in batting practice, he was maybe one of the better offensive performers in this game. 4-for-4 in a game like this is no joke. It's a difficult hitting environment. And to see him go 4-for-4, I think he really showed a lot of what he can do on both sides of the ball.
Other thing I would just bring up is in that's not an like, oh, look out, you know, that's kind of out of the blue or anything. Like when you talk about the three hitters we're going to talk about here, the 2.5 hitters that we're going to talk about here from this summer, his statistics, again, it's not every event, but we use Synergy Sports, kind of doesn't have the 4-for-4 for the Under Armour in there at least yet. But even before that, 355, 444, 579 this summer with kind of, I would describe it as gap to gap power. Like he has extra base hits to the right center power alley and to the left center power alley. Not really a pull hitter, more of kind of an up the middle approach, which is again, a good hitter approach. 18% swing and miss rate too. So a very solid especially for a guy who has real power.
Yeah.
There's nothing about him as a hitter where you're like, oh, this is a lip service of, oh, this guy thinks he's going to do that, but he's really just a pitcher who they're going to humor and let him hit because they want to bring him on to, you know, let him pitch. Like, no, this guy has real hitting ability too. I was impressed. Like you said, the BP was impressive. I would say that the only thing that you kind of have a little bit less understanding of right now when you say two-way player is because he's such a pitcher, you're not going to get as many looks. You don't get as much work from him as a physician player in the field as you do. Not that he didn't play, but you're not seeing the same thing of like, oh, okay, here's how he projects every time out if you're throwing in the game, you don't want him also getting a lot of throws at third base or wherever else you want to put him.
Yeah, he ranked number 15 on our 2028 high school list prior to his reclassification. I would imagine roughly he's probably going to rank somewhere on the top 50 of our universal draft board. Drake Hopp right now is ranked number 53 overall. He's number 20 in the high school list. So it's not always a one-to-one. The classes vary in strength, but I would be a little bit surprised if we didn't see Cullen Scott kind of in the top half of this ranking when we update. Two other players.
Mentioned Drake Hopp. So just talk.
Yeah, let's get into Drake Hopp. Drake Hopp, another probably, this is a hitter only. Drake Hopp, the son of big leaguer Brad Hopp. He has, we've talked about him in the past as well. He has been, for me, maybe the most well-rounded offensive player in terms of showing an ability to hit, showing an ability to get on base, and showing in-game power. I think the offensive operation is just really impressive to me. It's an unusual looking swing. It's not the most fluid left-handed swing you'll ever see. There's a bit of this like late trigger action, but it's extremely twitchy. He has a lot of bat speed. He has easy raw power. I think, again, in batting practice, he maybe showed some of the furthest hit fly balls in the batting practice round. Even if he's a corner outfielder, I think we saw that he had an arm that could fit nicely in right field. It looks like a plus arm to me. And so I think beyond this specific event, just what Drake Hopp has done throughout the summer, regularly being in the middle of the lineup, regularly being one of the seemingly most feared hitters that the pitchers are trying to navigate around, showing an ability to hit all pitch types, use the entirety of the field, has been impressive to me. I imagine he's going to be one of the more exciting offensive players in this high school class at this stage. So yeah, I would expect him to move much closer into the top 50 than kind of just being on the fringe right now. His profile isn't one that screams first rounder unless you're really bullish on the hitting ability and power. And we'll see. Maybe scouts will come back and say, yeah, he definitely is, because he has some of those corner limitations. Maybe we're talking about right outside of that range, but I think he should be an up arrow guy regardless at this point. I don't know if you've seen enough of Drake at this stage to comment as well, JJ, but he's one of my favorite bats in the class at this point.
Not as much as you, obviously, but at the same time, like we should note also made the call, you know, the teammate USA 18U national team, where, as you kind of laid out, there are very few pure outfielders on that team. You know, Drake Hopp kind of, I think, will be heavily relied on, not just with his bat, but also as someone who is not just an infielder moonlighting in the outfield, but someone who's a real outfielder. you said the profile is the one thing that if you said, like, I think there is kind of a limitation to how high he's going to be up on these rankings, because you are talking about bats, you know, bats left, throws right. And that kind of is, I would say there's always a little bit of indication there of like what your ultimate athleticism is when you say like probably corner outfielder, good, you know, could probably right. But like that's, there's, when it comes to the top of the draft board, we see more high school shortstops going at the top than we do.
Yeah, let me just pull up last year. So last year's high school hitters, our first corner outfielder or corner profile. So if you're a center fielder, if you're a catcher, if you're a middle infielder, and I'll even include third baseman here. I think that's a more attractive position than either first base or either corner outfield position. So Jared Greinlinger at 12, I think a bit of an outlier just because the pure hitting ability in youth gave him such a huge edge for model heavy teams. So Jared Greinlinger to go 12. After him, the first true corner profile that we're looking at, you could maybe say, not even call Prosek. He's drafted as a second baseman. He has catching. You're getting into the 40s and 50s now before we get to a true corner outfielder. It's all shortstops through the third round. I'd say Andrew Giles at pick 108 in the fourth round to the Pirates. Maybe Kevin Roberts. I would put Kevin Roberts in center field and see how long he can play there. But Andrew Giles, to me, is the first player we get to on the high school side drafted last year who is like, you can look at and say, okay, he might very well be a corner outfielder. I think Drake Homp offensively has already done more than Andrew Giles did a year ago. But that maybe is just to emphasize what teams are prioritizing for their high school bats. They want up the middle players.
The other thing I would mention with Greinlinger, because you know what I would say with him is it's a little different, is okay, if you bat left, throw left, then the only profiles you could effectively have are you could be a center field profile, you could be a first base profile, or you could be a corner outfielder profile. But that's pretty much the list.
And so then obviously Greinlinger had the two way factor as well. Right. So,
but if you throw right, then that's a different. If you kind of, I would say that there's a clear distinction there between corner outfield profile, throw left. Okay, well, where else are you going to play versus throw right, where it's like, okay, that means you've already edged down the spectrum as compared to the vast majority of prep players in a class. Mm-hmm. Speaking of guys who play kind of all over the place, you know, who have that ability, we've seen, we've seen Malachi Butler kind of bounce around the infield depending on who else is playing at that time. But I would say Malachi Butler very much fits the profile of what you were talking about of a infielder, a shortstop who can also probably, like you said, we talked about him on the podcast. I think last week we talked about for 18 U's, very probably going to be the third baseman on that team. But we've seen him at shortstop. We've seen him kind of multiple places. But what is it about him this summer that is raising him up the list?
I think it is. It's that profile question you talk about when you're a shortstop and your bat's left, throws right. I think that's kind of the ideal sort of situation you want to see. He's young for the class. He'll be 17 at the draft. He's super well-rounded in terms of tool set, power, arm strength. Doesn't have the best running ability in the world, but I think he's shown a very polished offensive approach, the ability to use all fields, the ability to track the ball, get on base when he needs to. He doesn't swing and miss a ton. And for me, JJ, I feel like this event's super useful because all the infielders are going through a pro-style workout. And so even if you're not getting reps at shortstop in-game, or even if you play shortstop, you don't get a ball hit to you, you can see every single player who's playing shortstop regularly go through an in and out defensively. And I don't know about you, but Malachi Butler to me had the most impressive shortstop in and out of the field, which I was excited to see because for so much of my time watching Malachi Butler, it's been with Team USA where he's often playing third base because there's so many other shortstops on that team. The first time I saw him, he was playing third base, and physically he looks like a typical third baseman because of his size. And so I think early on, I kind of pigeonholed myself into just thinking about him as a third baseman. But I do not think that at all now. I think he has all of the actions, the footwork, the exchange, the fluid movement that you want to see from a big league shortstop. He certainly has the arm strength for the position. So that in particular was exciting to me. And then when he takes a batting practice, I just feel like it's a very professionally minded BP. He's using the opposite field with intent and a more natural ability to go to the opposite field than I feel like most high school hitters show at this level. And especially when you factor in his age, he's maybe half a year younger than Drake Hopp is, but he doesn't look like it. So I just think there's a sort of well-rounded tool set and solid performance all spring that makes me personally really excited about Malachi Butler. I don't know. I'm sure the questions for him are going to be, okay, what's the ultimate upside? Like, are the tools just more 50s, 55s? Are there a bunch of 60s that you can put on the card and dream on? That probably is going to be the question for him. But I do feel like if you're just looking down the list and saying, what boxes do you want your young high school shortstops to check? He checks a lot of them for me.
To go back to what we said at the start about the emphasis on hit tools, Drake Hopp, again, for what we have this summer, 17.5% strikeout rate. Butler, 10.5%. Like, Butler is one of the best, I would think, bat-to-ball skills. 12% swing and miss rate in the events that we have in the database on Synergy Sports. That's like a really good swing and miss rate. And it's not a guy who's just a singles hitter either. There is some pop here. There is some athleticism. There is, like you said, the infield actions, all that. And again, when you say like ultimate profile, even if you're someone who says like, whose evaluation is, I think this long-term ends up being a third baseman.
Right.
Okay. That's not a, there's nothing about what we just laid out where you go, oh, well, that would be a real problem if that happened. It would be more like he kind of fits the profile that you're looking there. But I think he's very much right now someone that you would at least send out as a shortstop and then see kind of long term. We talk about, you know, Grady Emerson from last year's class where it's like, he's going to go out as a shortstop. We'll see. Maybe he's a shortstop long term. Maybe he's a third baseman, but the bat's probably going to work it either. I would say that Malachi Butler kind of fits that kind of profile as well.
Yeah, I agree. I think so too. I think he give him every opportunity to play shortstop. And if you have to move to third base, maybe you're talking about an above average or plus defender at the position with a still really well-rounded offensive package.
The and other one maybe that we the need last to talk player about,
is the most obvious.
I was going to say the one that we know, like when we do these, we are iterative in our rankings. We think there's a real value. I've had people yell at me and say that you all just move rankings around just to get clicks. And it's like, no, we really don't. I mean, we really do believe in the value of regularly updating allows you to try to both carry what you already knew, but make adjustments. Yeah. And the other thing we also know from a practical standpoint, when we reach out to people and say, how do you line everything up, which we try to do with our reporting, one of the things we also know is you get more feedback after you've done the ranking than you do before. Some of them may notice a player or two, but then you get the full ranking and we get feedback like, oh, I think you're too high on this guy, too low on this guy.
Right.
That's the other value of the iterative rankings. George Ferguson is someone who we know is, from the last update to now, has kind of changed his profile, hasn't he?
Right. Yeah. And I'll just say once on the iterative ranking side, just from a process standpoint, I think we've done we care a lot about this, obviously. So we've looked into a lot of different aspects and there have been a lot of studies done in various fields when you're trying to make projections, predict the future. The people who are most accurate are the people who are updating most frequently. And that allows you to incorporate all sorts of different input to readjust your evaluations, to change your mind, to change your opinion. We're not just moving players around to move them around. We're constantly trying to react to all the different pieces of feedback we're getting relentlessly. And I feel like the more you do that, the better the product is going to be. So that is kind of going a little bit behind the scenes in terms of the process for us. If we just did one ranking a year, there's a lot of players change. The reality of covering baseball prospects is, especially at this age, players are changing rapidly. They're getting bigger. They're getting stronger. They're getting more skilled. They're getting less skilled. They're backing up. They're improving different pitches that they're throwing. They're getting more reps against competition. They're having growth spurts. They're getting in the gym. They're getting new coaches. And so they're changing rapidly. We need to reflect that to the best of our ability. And we're never pushing out a ranking that's half baked or we haven't done the work on. So it's just a lot of year round regular work to update these. And so I am a full believer in iterative rankings and we'll continue to do so because our product is better because of that. And hopefully that's what you guys want to see. So yeah, George Ferguson, let me not butcher the names here. I think there's a case for him as a top high school pitcher in the class. Essentially, you saw him in the game. I wasn't able to see the actual game this year at Under Armour. I just saw the workout. But I was very excited for you to see George Ferguson in person, JJ, because the first time I saw him, and I believe this is also the case for Jacob at the Area Code Games, he just really wowed in a big way. And for me, it's between Connor Salerno, the left-handed pitcher of North Carolina, and George Ferguson as the top pitcher in the class. What did you see of him in the game on Sunday?
It's obviously one inning, right? So it was a good inning. But again,
I got to see three, so I have the advantage on you.
I got to see an inning. It was a really good inning. But I would say it's hard. You don't want to. I've watched some of the Area Code as well. You know, from a on Synergy to kind of understand it as well. But what I would say is, if that's not in consideration for the top prep pitcher in the class, then I won't know why he's not right. Like, and I say that from the standpoint of there's not really anything lacking. Someone may then say, well, you just talked about Colin Scott, and Colin Scott throws harder, not a ton harder, but he throws harder than George Ferguson. But I would say, when it comes to kind of what you just said, like the control, the command, the secondaries, I would say that they're a little further along right now from what I saw than Colin Scott.
Yeah.
And that's not that Colin Scott can't get there or anything like that, but George Ferguson, I would have felt like, which not shocking, one of these guys just reclassified. I would say that he's a little further on. And we saw that obviously when we talk about Team USA again. Like, we saw this when you talk about them kind of putting together their 18U team and all as well. Like, Ferguson was really good there. You know, Scott was, I would say, good. But then, like you said, I think you mentioned on the podcast last week, at phase two, you know, he was not as sharp.
Very scattered. Like, the pure stuff and the ease with which the ball came out of his hand was obvious. But George Ferguson was a much more advanced pure pitcher. What stood out to me when I saw him at USA again, I saw him for a little bit more extended than you. I saw him three innings, and so maybe a chance to see more of those secondaries. But I felt like his fastball was obviously plus at the time. It was 95, 97, touch 98. I think that's a similar velocity range to what you saw in his first inning. But then his changeup was just such an obvious plus pitch to me right away. Throwing it at 87, 89 miles per hour, a ton of power and a ton of movement at that power. I feel like it's rare to see high school pitchers throwing a changeup near 90 miles per hour. In general, when they do, it's typically more of a firm, kind of straight changeup, that there's not a lot of visual difference between the fastball. And sometimes that can be beneficial, just because maybe it's a little bit more deceptive. Maybe the hitter can't pick up on the difference as much. But this one has this parachuting diving action to the point where I was wondering, hey, is this like an actual splitter? I don't think it is. He's just able to generate a ton of vertical movement with the pitch. He got a lot of swing and miss. He got a lot of ground balls. And then he also showed a potentially above average, maybe also plus in the future, breaking ball. Another pitch with impressive power for a high school secondary in the mid-80s. Really impressive glove side sweep at times. It's already an effective right-on-right chase pitch. And so you're looking at a pitcher who's up to 98 miles per hour, throws a lot of strikes with the fastball, has a now changeup, has a real ability to spin the baseball. People are going to nitpick the delivery because it looks a little bit unusual. I don't know if you had any thoughts on how the delivery worked, but if he's on time, he's throwing strikes, he's got a full arsenal, that's kind of all you need to do. And there are a lot of different pitchers at the big leagues who look a little bit different. So I don't think that'll be something that's held against him too much.
When you say look a little different, I always kind of want to follow it up. Is there something about it that not just looks different, but creates a potential problem, right?
Like, correct.
Because if you say it looks different because he's cutting himself off, it looks different because his arm's not on time, it looks different because there's massive, you know, recoil at the end, things like that. Mm-hmm. It's really short. Even like if you said, like, it's really short in the back, there just aren't a whole lot of starters that you see in the major leagues. Not that you haven't seen any. Lucas Giolito reworked his delivery to be really short in the back. But those are things where I'm like, okay, you're now going beyond it's unusual to this is a potential concern. I didn't get anything of that, you know, with Ferguson, at least so far.
Yeah, I don't have that either. I'll be curious if in any conversations with scouts, more like in-depth pitching analysts, if they have anything to say about like some maybe red or yellow flags in the delivery. I think it mostly just a little bit of an unconventional look. And for me, I'm trying to get beyond that. I think in the past I've been a little bit too critical of deliveries that look unusual, even though, like you say, nothing about the delivery is preventing them from being on time or repeating or executing their pitches. So I'm trying to be a little bit more open-minded and for that moving forward. But
yeah, the other thing I would say with that is you hit on it, I think a good way to evaluate too, which is if you see unusual and the guy's all over the place and he's missing arm side high one pitch and then he's missing, you know, glove side down the next, and it's really scattershot, well, then you have an indication that he's trouble. This pitcher's having trouble repeating. But if you're repeating and you're able to do so time after time, again, that's a, you've kind of a removed at least some of that concern, because that's what deliveries are supposed to be able to do, is get you into a place where you can release the pitch from the same spot over and over on time, as far as synced up with your delivery, to where you're not causing a lot of control troubles come from an inability to do the same thing over and over. So, but when you look at him, when you look at him where he is right now, and we look at, I think it's useful to kind of have a little bit bigger picture. I will say his changeup's so good, it actually is a little bit worrisome to me, because while that's great.
Oh no.
I'm just saying, like, that I expect a prep pitcher with a great changeup who throws up to 98 to dominate, because even the best high school hitters, they're not used to seeing that combo together. We see this over and over, even in the minors, right? When it's kind of,
you can dominate the low minors if they're hard and have a good changeup and can land a good changeup. Yep.
Because no one, that's a really advanced skill for a hitter, right? A hitter who can handle that usually is not found in the lower minors or in amateur baseball. They are found in the upper minors, or especially in the major leagues, because if you have that skill, you are probably a really good hitter. And that's not a knock against Ferguson. I'm just saying, like, I expect him, like, if you said, who's more likely to dominate, a fastball, great changeup right-hander in high school, or a fastball slider, I would say that those hitters are really more used, and they really want to face more of like a nasty slider off of a fastball, because that's kind of almost like, that's the challenge they're looking for. They're geared up. Everything's in hard. Whereas if you have that changeup off of it, they don't want to face that. They really hate seeing that changeup, I think.
Right. Yeah. I would be more concerned if this was a case where George Ferguson didn't have a track record of throwing a good breaking ball. If he was always a fastball changeup pitcher and was maybe a natural pronator who just couldn't spin the ball well. But in the past, Ferguson has been a fastball breaking ball forward pitcher. He can throw the breaking ball with power. He can spin it at an above average rate as well. And so because that aspect is not an element of concern for me, I'm just mostly excited about, like, the fully realized three pitch mix already. So I don't think it's a situation like Gary Morse from last year's class, right-handed pitcher out of Orange Lutheran. He was a very change up forward pitcher, and his breaking ball, there are real questions about his ability to spin that pitch. So I don't think it's a spin capacity question with George Ferguson. I just think he's a really talented, really well-rounded pitcher.
One other I did want to bring up, we wrote about him, but I would say, like, it was notable because Chubb Jones came into the summer as one of the top pitching prospects in the class, and it's been a pretty uneven summer. There's been a lot of control problems. It was good to see he was easily, and I haven't seen him that many times this summer, but he was easily the best I've seen of him. The most important thing being that he threw strikes, right? He basically went out there for two innings. He only got to go two innings at the Intermar game. And
which in this game, that's getting extended in a showcase game like this, two innings.
Yeah. He was throwing strikes generally. I'm not saying there weren't misses, but when he had a miss, he then responded the next pitch by being back in the zone, which is much more what you're kind of looking to see. And so I did want to bring that up as a guy who, you know, it's been a little bit uneven at times. The other one that I just wanted to bring up, because I knew when I saw the thing I love about this event, right, is I love the rare cases where you get to be in an event and you're scouting fresh, you're watching fresh, you're evaluating fresh, that there are players who you know much less about. Obviously, I'd seen a lot of the guys already. I've read our reports and all. So when it comes to like a Lubin Rincon or even a Derek Vasquez, who, you know, for the next time, like, I knew those guys were coming in. But then to see Jordan Griffin, who's running back sized, he's 5'9", 190 pounds and built, but to see the speed, but also to see the hitting ability that I like to see, he had a good game as well. That's always fun for me when there's a guy who I think I've literally saw him his first round of BP, and then just kind of peeled off to go find you. And it's like, I really like this.
That's yeah, you did. Cool to see. I remember that. Yeah. So definitely check out our piece at baseballamerica.com for full notes on the Baseball Factory game in particular. And obviously we'll be in the works updating our 2027 draft board, our high school board, our college board, all that in the works after we get off the show. So
thanks. So that is the Baseball America draft podcast for this week. Carlos Galazzo, JJ Cooper. Thank you for joining us. Please do subscribe to the Baseball America podcast feed and YouTube channel. Leave a review on the podcast feed for wherever your favorite podcast catcher is. Helps other people see us. And obviously, if you have thoughts, share them on the YouTube. I love to respond. I really do. I respond a lot. I can't promise I get to every one of them, but I do try to hop on there most days, at least a little bit, check it out. And kind of, if you have questions, if you have thoughts, I like to kind of add to that conversation as well. And obviously, check out over baseballamerica.com. So much draft content all year round. Like we said, we don't kind of dive into this just for draft season. Draft season goes 365 days a year here at Baseball America. For Carlos, I'm JJ. So long, everybody.